Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Hi-o, Silver. Welcome to Ridiculous History. Thank you so much for tuning in. My name is Ben.
My name is Nolan. Ben, I feel like this was a missed opportunity to use the sound effects box.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not Christmas if it's every day, right?
Aren't there clippity-clops on that thing? They have to be.
I don't know. It's not a it's not a name brand.
That's fair.
Sound box.
I mean, it's just a grid of buttons. I mean, there's a good 24 buttons on there. I would think somewhere in there, it has a pogo stick for crying out loud. It ought to have a horse whinny and some clippity clops.
Yeah. But luckily, thanks to our third and better half of our show, super producer Casey Pegram, we have a multitude of sound clips. We are free from the sound clip box. But I like being able to, you know, do the DJ morning show radio
thing. Totally.
So, Noel, were you ever a fan of like the old school Wild West heroes?
Well, alas, I was born in the wrong era. If only I had been a child in the 1920s or so, I think I would have been all over it. But those things weren't as popular when I was a kid. I think there was shows like Lonesome Dove that I think were kind of more for the old folks. You know, I really wasn't. I was more into Ninja Turtles and Thundercats and things like that. There wasn't really a place for that Wild West stuff when I was a kid. But then I kind of found that kind of manufactured nostalgia when I got a little older and realized that stuff was pretty cool. And there was absolutely an era for that stuff where it was just everywhere.
Yeah. I think when I was growing up, I was always more impressed by fictional stories of people with extraordinary supernatural powers or strange fantastical situations. But once upon a time, the United States, as well as eventually the globe, was obsessed with these stories of very human heroes in the, again, largely fictionalized Wild West. A lot of these people come from this sort of gumbo, this cultural stew of different influences and different stories. But today, our story is a little bit of an argument. We are making a case for a real-life inspiration behind the legendary Lone Ranger. And you remember the Lone Ranger. You know about it, right?
Yeah, he was played by that guy Armie Hammer in that movie where Johnny Depp did the racist Indian character.
With a dead crow on his head. Or a raven, perhaps.
That's right, morbid. That's right.
Yeah. So the Lone Ranger is a Texas Ranger. He's like Zorro in the Wild West, kind of, because he has a mask.
Totally. And just to backtrack slightly, I wasn't saying that the character Johnny Depp portrayed was a racist Indian. I was just implying that it was probably a bit of cultural appropriation and a little problematic portrayal to have a white dude like Johnny Depp play Native American character. That's all I was getting at there.
Alas, the film did not perform as well as its creators had hoped.
Indeed. And I think that was probably part of the reason. And also, I think maybe it wasn't the best film in the world. But that character was a real character in The Lone Ranger, Tonto. Which was the Lone Ranger's trusty sidekick.
Yeah, the first time I learned about Tonto, I was reading one of my favorite comics growing up, The Far Side by Gary Larson, which may be returning. And there's this fantastic panel, some of us listening probably remember it, wherein the Lone Ranger, many years into his retirement, learns that Kemosabe means horse's ass or something like that. And I never learned whether that was true because you know how it is with comics when you're a kid. You take them at face value. Now, Casey, real quick, did you ever see that new Lone Ranger, the newest adaptation?
No, those kind of big franchise movies I tend to skip. And this was one that did not really catch my attention.
Yeah, I feel you. Noel, did you see it? You didn't see it.
I didn't see it. No, didn't catch my attention at all. I'm not a big fan of reboots, soft or otherwise. And again, I wasn't super into the source material in the first place, but also that Johnny Depp portrayal really did kind of rub me the wrong way. And it's interesting because I actually just pulled up an article on SmithsonianMag.com with the headline, "Is the new Tonto any better than the old Tonto?" Because as we know, portrayals of Native American characters in the golden age of television were pretty problematic themselves. All the more reason this origin story we've got today is particularly interesting.
Yes.
In terms of appropriation.
Yes, agreed. Let's also point out that during that golden age of television, many actors who were portraying Native Americans were not themselves Native Americans. So here's what we're going to do. In today's episode, we are going to build an argument that the Lone Ranger, as understood in fiction, film, and comics, was inspired by a real person who does not get enough credit, a fellow named Bass Reeves. So cast your memory back, as Van Morrison would say, to 1838, almost 100 years before anybody had ever heard of the Lone Ranger. There's a guy named Bass Reeves, and he is born in Arkansas, in Crawford County. He is born into slavery. It is the household of a politician named William S. Reeves.
Right, like I believe a state congressman.
Yeah, yeah, state legislator. This guy, Reeves, later moves to Paris in 1846.
Paris, France?
Paris, Texas.
Ah, yes.
Good distinction. Good catch there. So life in this horrific institution of chattel slavery was always a terrible proposition and enormously difficult and unjust. Reeves worked first as a water boy, and later he started working as a field hand. When William S. Reeves passed away, his son, George Reeves, made Bass his personal companion, kind of his manservant, sort of following him around, fixing things for him, doing chores. And then the Civil War occurred. During the Civil War, Reeves, George, and Bass both went into battle. They fought for the Confederacy. As you can imagine, this is, you know, not an ideal situation in general, because it's war, but it's uniquely terrible because Bass Reeves is essentially being forced to fight for the pro-slavery side of the Civil War.
Yeah, that's right. And it was during his time in the Civil War that he became embedded with a group of Native Americans. He was attempting to escape under cover of night for this is a debate as to what the reason was. One theory is that he got into a fist fight with his master over a card game dispute, and the other said that he heard that the slaves were going to be free and decided to pursue freedom himself. Either way, he ended up kind of bunking up with the Creek and Seminole Indian tribes in Oklahoma, or modern-day Oklahoma. And he really became one of them, essentially. I mean, he learned all of their languages and their customs, and he became quite an adept marksman through, you know, spending time with these tribes.
Yes, and at this time, he was also becoming a very talented scout and tracker. Later, he would say he knew the territories, meaning the Indian territories, like the back of his hand or the way a cook knows her kitchen. We should note this. When we say he learned their languages, he didn't learn just a few words. He actually spoke multiple languages. Bass Reeves was a polyglot. He had a prodigious memory, which comes into play later. He was assimilating into these tribes or befriending them during a very tumultuous time for these populations. Due to the Indian Removal Act of 1830, they had all been forced from their ancestral land. And the communities themselves were governed by an interlocking system of tribal courts, but these courts were only able to make any rulings. Their jurisdiction only allowed them to rule over members of those five major tribes. That meant that anyone else in the territories, whether they were people escaping slavery, whether they were criminals on the lam, all of those people could not be prosecuted by the tribal courts. They could only be pursued by federal level agents. This was the real Wild West, a lawless, ugly, dangerous place. And this is where Bass became a, well, I guess we'd call him a bad Bass. If we want to skirt around the Family Show requirements, he's a bad Bass.
Doesn't quite roll off the tongue, though, does it, Ben?
I like it.
I'm hard with double B sounds. It's always tricky for me to say. But I think your heart's in the right place, my friend. And his heart was in the right place, too, in terms of kind of becoming this sort of symbol, almost, of justice, kind of, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, eventually. Because so he was on the run. He himself would be considered an escaped slave until 1865. After the 13th Amendment was passed, Bass Reeves was no longer on the lam. He was officially a free man, or he was on paper, because as we know, despite the 13th Amendment's passage, despite the fact that people were manumitted, in practice, they were still often enslaved.
That's right. So he no longer had to kind of hide in plain sight among the Native American people, and he was able to kind of go out on his own and using some of those skills that he honed, you know, during his time with the Creek and Seminole tribes to kind of make some scratch for himself. He started to use his tracking abilities and then that marksmanship to help lawmen track down very dangerous criminals who were on the lam, not just like for being a black man, but for actually perpetrating some pretty heinous crimes. And he was doing society a service by helping track a lot of these guys down. But this was just the beginning of what would ultimately become a pretty insane ride that Reeves Bass would go on.
Yeah. Bass Reeves is becoming a bad Bass, but he's not a Lone Ranger yet. He works in Van Buren, Arkansas, and in that area, that region, for about 10 years. And then something happens, and it changes his life. Federal Judge Isaac C. Parker is appointed to oversee the Indian Territory. And during the chaos and the pandemonium of the Civil War, as we had said earlier, this territory became a hive of scum and villainy, as they say in Star Wars.
That's right.
So Parker hires a guy named U.S. Marshal James F. Fagan. And there's an excellent article about this on allthat'sinteresting.com.
To lead a bit of a posse, huh?
Yeah, to lead a posse. This is back when you could just deputize people, like we deputized Casey earlier. And he says, you know, Marshal Fagan, I need you to round up 200 good men to be deputies. We're going to bring the law to these parts. And so Fagan is looking for recruits. He hears about Reeves.
Yeah. And Reeves answers the call because he's kind of perfect for this, because he knows this part of the country like the back of his hand, because he's lived in it. He's lived off the land. He knows every nook and cranny, and he is absolutely perfect to help track down some of these fugitives in and around these Indian territories. Fagan hears about Reeves, and Reeves says, yes, I will come help you out. And he is soon, after showing his smarts and his acumen and his ability to really be helpful, is hired as an official U.S. deputy marshal.
200 deputies may sound like a little bit of overkill until you consider the size of the territory. It is ballpark. It is 75,000 square miles. So they needed all the help they could get. And while Bass was not the only African-American hired for this or deputized, he was one of the few, and he was by far, out of all 200, he was one of the standouts. Let's paint a picture of the man. He's 6'2". He's a skinny guy. He rides an iconic white stallion, and he has a black hat two Colt 45 peacemakers. He's known for his slick suits and his highly polished shoes, but don't mistake him for a Western-themed dandy, folks. Over the time in his career, he sent a record-breaking 3,000 felons to justice, which means that he was in some hairy situations, but somehow he never actually got shot, which is amazing for anyone who's been in a firefight.
And it's funny too, because I mean, you know, the character of the Lone Ranger really is almost like a Western James Bond. You know, he's got this kind of panache to his character where he's all about kind of like, he's a slick talker just as much as he is a sharp shooter, you know, and he can talk his way out of situations and uses his smarts just as much as he uses his gunslinging abilities. And Reeves was no different. He was, in fact, known as a master of disguise and would often dress up as like a farmer or, you know, a cowboy. And when we say cowboy, we just mean like literally someone who was herding, you know, stallions. And he had a calling card. He would always leave a silver dollar behind when he had apprehended one of these felons.
Yeah, that's a true story, even though it sounds like something devised by Hollywood. We also want to note, we talked about his prodigious memory. He had one disadvantage cognitively that a lot of people are not aware of, and that's that he was illiterate. He had never learned how to read or write. And because of this, before he went out in the field, he would have someone read him the warrants for the people he was chasing, and he would memorize them. He would also use this to distract outlaws. You know, he would come up to them with a warrant or some other innocuous letter, and then he would stop them in the middle of what was about to be a shootout and say, "Hey, can you read this for me? Because I can't read too well." And then they're like, "What? You want me to read you out loud?" But it was too late. He had drawn the peacemaker. And he's like, "Get down or I'll put you down." He also, I love that you mentioned the disguise thing. It reminds me a little bit of the original A-Team, where I believe, what was the guy's name who was always smoking the cigars? I know the actor was George Peppard.
Mr. T.
No.
There was another character in the A-Team besides Mr. T?
Yeah, there were four. There was The Face, there was Murdoch. Who was the crazy pilot.
Okay.
And then there was the main guy with the silver hair.
Huh.
Well, he was like, okay, the main guy with silver hair in Mr. T. The guy's name was Hannibal. He was the one who put the A-Team together. Hannibal was a lot like Bugs Bunny in that he would go out of his way to use disguises. Those disguises, by the way, aged like milk and are pretty problematic nowadays. But Bass Reeves was doing a real-life version of this. Like you said, Noel, he would not just dress up as a benign farmer. He would also pretend to be an outlaw on the run from himself. How cool is that? And he would create backstories for his characters. Like, this guy was an amazing actor. In a different world, in a universe to the left of ours, he is walking the planks in London doing Shakespeare. So one time, this is a true story, he walked 30 miles dressed as a homeless itinerant beggar on the lam, on the run from the law. And he did this so that the people he was coming for would not, you know, hear that the legendary Bass Reeves was just a few miles away. He would just be another faceless person in the morass of poverty. And when he got to the home of his target, he was after these two brothers. The mother invites him in because he's like, "Oh, I'm having such a tough time. I've got nothing. I'm on my last legs. The law is after me. May I, you know, get shelter?" And he manipulates this lady into saying, well, come on. You know, it's the Christian thing to do. You can stay the night here. You don't have to sleep rough tonight." So he says, "Okay, I'll do that." And then while he is pretending to be asleep, he waits for the brothers to go to sleep, and then he arrests them in their sleep. And he walks them the 30 miles back to camp.
Yeah, but he kind of spared the mother the embarrassment of having to witness that, you know?
Yeah, she was probably asleep,
that's
too.
That's what I mean.
She woke up at some point.
At some point. But I don't know. There's part of me that thinks that that was sort of a thoughtful calculus on his part.
A kindness?
Maybe.
Well, maybe she just woke up and saw a silver dollar on the empty bed.
I mean, they were probably rotten kids anyway. You know, she was probably happy to be rid of them. They had it coming, clearly.
I don't know. A mother's love is a pretty...
You're right about
pretty
that.
...strong thing.
That's a good point, Ben. I always forget about a mother's love.
But she was probably glad they were alive.
That's fair.
Unless they were going to be sentenced to hang.
He could have killed them in their sleep.
He could have. He could have. And it was classy that he didn't. So we see already the makings of this legend, the bones of this modern American mythology.
Because when I say earlier in the show he became this symbol of justice, that's a big part of it. Because he wasn't known as some sort of like cash crazy murderer for hire, you know? He was absolutely someone who was bringing people in. He was an agent of the law.
Yeah, he was not a sadist, nor was he a bloodthirsty monster. He was actually, if he were in D&D, he would be a paladin. He had a code. He also, because he never got shot, he got nicknames like the Indomitable Marshal or the Invincible Marshal. And even while he was alive, people were starting to build this myth around him. They said that he had superhuman strength, that he had this, photographic or eidetic memory, and he had plenty of close calls. Now, we don't know how many of these are true, but you'll hear stories about a bullet knocking his hat off. Or maybe he's riding after someone, they shoot at him, but instead of hitting him, they hit the reins on his horse. And we have an actual example of what came to be known as his letter trick, right? It comes from Art Burton, I think?
Yeah, Art Burton in the very creatively titled Black Gun, Silver Star, The Life and Legend of Frontier Marshal Bass Reeves. And at one point, he was on the hunt for two Texans who'd been accused of murder, and they actually put one over on old Marshall Reeves, and they got the drop on him. And he, in the form of this story, he saw them on the road, and they asked if, just very candidly, "Are you Bass Reeves?" And he said that he wasn't.
And they said, "What do you take us for, some kind of simpletons?"
That's right. And they pulled their pistols on him. And they, basically at gunpoint, forced him to ride along with them until they could find someone that could corroborate their, their story, that he was, in fact, the notorious lawman Bass Reeves.
So you could do stunts like this before the age of social media.
Now let's not forget too, that's totally true, Ben. Let's not forget too, can you imagine this guy must have taken some abuse from some of these hayseeds, you know?
Of course, yeah.
I mean, I can't even imagine, just the amount of horrible name calling and disrespect that he would have gotten, probably at the hands of his own colleagues, he probably would have been quite resented.
And, for a time,
yes. I mean, I just it's very profound, I think, that he pushed forward and was like so committed to this life and to this job that he clearly, that was not an issue for him.
He is all about commitment because he also committed to his characters. I love this story. This is one of my favorite Bass Reeves stories. So these guys have the brilliant idea that they're going to pull firearms on this dude, and they literally say, "Well, you're going to ride with us till we see someone who can tell us who you are in or who you ain't."
That's right. So exactly right. They're riding along with him at gunpoint
for a long time
until they can find someone that can confirm or deny that this is in fact the notorious, I'm repeating myself, lawman Bass Reeves. And after riding along for some time, they got kind of tired of the whole thing, and they ordered him down off his horse so that they could end his life. They were going to execute him summarily on the side of the road. And, being the class acts that they were, they offered him the wonderful movie moment of a final famous last words, right?
"You have any last words?" And again, to the point about racism, they may have called him boy or something like that. Here's what he did. This is brilliant. He said, "Well, I have a letter from my wife, and I can't read. I would dearly love for you fine gentlemen to read it to me. I want to hear from her before I pass from this mortal plane. They had gotten off their horses too, of course. So he tells them he's reaching for this letter, and he passes it to them with shaking hands, on the verge of tears. It was a great act. These guys were convinced. So, you know, it's classic misdirection, the way a stage magician works. They put their eyes on the letter, and stupidly enough, they take their eyes off the very dangerous Bad Bass Reeves. And that's when he draws his gun. Here's my question in the plot.
Yeah, they didn't pat him down?
Right. Why did he still have his guns? Were they just confident they could shoot him before he could reach the peacemakers?
I guess, but it's like they're riding along with him for all that time. It's the first thing you do when you take someone hostage is you pat him down and remove any weapons they have on their person. Maybe he had a secret piece.
You know? Secret peacemaker?
A secret peacemaker, yeah.
Maybe.
I don't know. It is a little idiotic and speaks to these gentlemen's intelligence level that they wouldn't have found those and done something about it. But, you know, and then that's all she wrote.
Yeah. He drew his gun on the Tweedledee holding that letter. And when he drew his gun, the other character, who I'll call Tweedledum, dropped his own gun in surprise. So Reeves bought them both in. They survived. This trick worked so well that he would rinse and repeat, using it a number of times over the course of his career. But here's the thing. Remember, I mentioned earlier that he was a real-life paladin. For anybody familiar with Dungeons & Dragons, he was real-life lawful good. You know about the alignment thing, right? You know what I'm talking about? Like lawful good, chaotic good.
Of course.
Yeah. So he's lawful good, and lawful good characters are sticklers for the rules, even when the rules, they'll do what the law says, even when the law maybe gives them an ethical conflict. His son, Benny Reeves, was charged with murdering his wife, who is Bass Reeves' daughter-in-law. This happened in 1902. When the charges were announced, the way it's depicted, and by the way, a fantastic drunk history segment. I love that show. We should get on that show. I don't want to be the person telling the story. I want to be in the reenactment.
Do they actually get to drink, or is it just pretend?
I think sometimes they're being performative, but I think the people who are telling these stories are actually drinking. The actors are sober.
That makes sense.
So anyway, these charges are read out. You know, Benny Reeves, charged with the murder of his wife. Bass Reeves is sitting in the back of the room, and no other deputy wants to take the case because they all, at this point, they all respect Bass Reeves. And so what does the man do? He takes on the case himself, and he arrests his own son. Benny Reeves goes on to serve more than two decades at Leavenworth.
I mean, remember earlier when we were talking about a mother's love? Doesn't that apply to a father's love too, Ben? That really must have been hard for him to do.
I guess the law was like his mom and dad.
Exactly. He loved the law more than he loved his own son. Poetic, tragic, but again, a stickler for justice, and you got to give the man credit for that. He was a man of integrity through and through, and he just exemplified that thirst for justice that, you know, they tried to hit on in The Lone Ranger.
And Bass Reeves, after his long career, passes away on January 12, 1910. He has survived to the ripe old age of 71, and he passes away in Oklahoma. However, his story doesn't stop there. Recall at the top of the episode, we said this is going to be a matter of us building a case, right? So we referenced earlier the excellent book Black Gun, Silver Star by Art T. Burton. That came out in 2006, so it didn't have a lot of the muckraking journalism that was common in the 1800s and early 1900s. And Burton points out that despite the fact he was a bad bass, Reeves was fired in 1907, not because he did a good job, but because Oklahoma became a state and Bass was African-American. So he was not allowed under the new state laws to continue in his position as deputy marshal. Instead, he joined the police department.
After all that service, you know, just to kind of get cast off, And it's weird that, was it a federal thing?
It was a state law.
Yeah.
It was the racial discrimination encoded in state law. And it's a horrible, horrible story, at least that part of it. And it tells us a lot about the banality of evil. But as we said, his story doesn't end there. This is where the Lone Ranger comes in. People who remember the original television show, comics, stuff like that, will recall that the Lone Ranger was portrayed as a white character. However, we have, along with our research associate Gabe, a pretty solid argument that the Lone Ranger was inspired by Bass Reeves, was heavily inspired by Bass Reeves, and that the Lone Ranger, as we understand it in popular fiction of the time, was just another case of whitewashing, kind of like how there was that moment a few months or years back when Scarlett Johansson was going to get cast as like every character of color. Do you remember this?
She definitely got cast as the Ghost in the Shell lead, and that was problematic in and of itself. But I think there was a role that she ultimately turned down.
Mm-hmm.
No, I know what it was. She was going to be a trans character, and that created a big uproar because, you know, there are plenty of fantastic trans actors out there that deserve those roles, and Scarlett Johansson doesn't need to get every part. But that's the thing. That kind of attitude in Hollywood, while maybe not inherently malicious, it's got a history.
Mm-hmm. So, Burton is our inroad to build the case for Bass Reeves being the real Lone Ranger. First, he says, look, they have the same kind of horses, gray or white. They're known for using disguises. They have a lot of interaction with people in the American Indian population, you know, specifically trackers, a.k.a. Tonto.
Mm-hmm.
And they have distinctive calling cards. The Lone Ranger left silver bullets, but the real-life one, Bass Reeves, as we said, left folks a silver dollar, which is so baller. What a power move. It adds up, too, right? If he left a silver—I was thinking about the math. If he left a silver dollar as a calling card for every felon he took in, 3,000, right, he took in, and he killed 14, then does that mean that he eventually left $3,014 just laying around?
Yeah, that seems like a pretty pricey calling card, doesn't it?
It does. It's like, oh no, the Fabergé egg murderer strikes again.
Exactly. No, that's a good point. And another good point that's in this CNN.com article is the idea of where this black mask came from, which is maybe almost an insult to injury kind of form of appropriation, right? Mm. I mean, they make this argument that it's almost symbolic that the black mask that the Lone Ranger wore could be compared to the fact that Reeves, by being a black man, was almost, he was not seen as a full human, therefore maybe would not have been seen as a threat in some way. That was his greatest ability, and this figured into his ability to disguise himself and not present a threat in a world that marginalized men that looked like him.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also a geographical link, right? The idea of Detroit, because a lot of the criminals that Reeves captured were later sent to lock up in Detroit. And the creators of the Lone Ranger, George Trendle and Franz Stryker, came up with the idea of the Lone Ranger in Detroit. So it's not a hard order of operations. Like, it's not hard evidence, but there's very strong circumstantial evidence. We can plausibly imagine Trendle and Stryker being aware of this piece of Detroit history and then knowing the story of Bass Reeves. It's strange because they may not have even known Bass Reeves himself. Maybe there was just a bunch of conversation amidst these felons about this particular individual, this, as you said, iconic individual who captured them. And Burton says, you know, I can't 100% prove that Bass Reeves inspired the Lone Ranger, but he is by far the closest person in real life with these characteristics.
But the thing is that Bass Reeves' story and the things that he actually accomplished as a real-life human person are beyond the scope of anything that, our hero, the Lone Ranger, could have ever possibly done on a television show. I mean, think about like what I mentioned earlier when we were just talking about, how difficult it must have been for him to exist in this society. Not only that, to command respect and to be effective. I mean, he really was this kind of triple threat of a man. I mean, and really, really, really admirable qualities, and that a commitment to justice, and that heartbreaking moment where he had to arrest his own son. That's the kind of stuff you just can't write, you know? I mean, it's fascinating what a life this guy led.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, some of you may be wondering, why haven't I been insisting the whole time that this should be a film? That's because this character has already occurred in numerous things. There's a short film on YouTube about him. He was also featured in a short film in 2013 called They Die by Dawn. And he was briefly in the HBO adaptation of Watchmen, right?
Oh, that is him.
Yeah.
That character in the old black and white kind of silent film reels.
That inspires Hood of Justice.
That's right.
Yeah. And there's a new Lionsgate film called Hell on the Border coming out that follows the story of Bass Reeves. Of course, it's a little bit fictionalized, but it sounds pretty good. It stars David Gyasi along with Frank Grillo, the guy who's Crossbones in the Marvel movies, playing a villain again, surprise. And Ron Perlman, who's a grizzled, you know, heart of gold helper, sidekick. But Bass Reeves himself, would he have liked the movie? We don't know. We do know that he was nothing if not consistent. Once someone asked him why he spent so much effort enforcing what they called the white man's laws, Bass replied, "Maybe the law ain't perfect, but it's the only one we got. And without it, we got nothing."
And in addition to a handful of books, we've got Burton's book and another one that we mentioned earlier, and the portrayals in a lot of this popular culture stuff that's kind of coming around. Some of this lost legacy of Bass Reeves is really starting to kind of be righted. And one of the most official examples of that was Reeves' induction into the Texas Trail of Fame back in 2013. He has had bronze statues erected and a bridge in Oklahoma named after him. So finally getting a little credit where credit is due.
Yes, finally. Maybe he would argue that the wheels of justice grind slow but exceedingly fine. I believe that along with our author, Mr. Burton, we have made a pretty convincing case, if not watertight, that Bass Reeves was indeed the inspiration for the Lone Ranger. We would love to hear your thoughts. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. Please let us know other historical figures that you believe have yet to get their due. We would love to dive into their stories. In the meantime, as always, we should tell people where to find us.
Yeah, you can find us in the usual spots as a show entity, as a triumvirate, me, Ben, super producer Casey Pegram, on the social channels, your social platform of choice. We've got the Facebook, we've got the Instagram, where we're Ridiculous History. Our favorite one, where we can actually spend a little time and hang out with you and your fellow listeners, is the Ridiculous History Facebook page called The Ridiculous Historians. All you got to do is name one, two, all three of us, make some reference to something in the show, or just make us laugh, and you are in like Flynn, my friends. We also all exist as independent human beings, after all. You can find me exclusively on Instagram, where I am at HowNowNoelBrown.
You can find me on my various misadventures on Instagram, named in a burst of creativity, at Ben Bolin, spelled like Bolin, but without the G. You can also find me on Twitter, where I am at Ben Bolin, HSW, a reference that the old heads may well appreciate.
Ben, I gotta tell you, you got some good musings on Twitter.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I know you're lurking on Twitter.
Oh, I'm a lurker.
Yeah.
I'm not a tweeter.
And you don't really like stuff, but you read it.
I don't like it. I don't retweet it. I don't do any of it. I just lurk.
Yeah.
And I remember.
Interesting.
I know.
What inspired you?
What inspired me to lurk?
Mm-hmm.
Just not particular interest. I guess. Yeah. No, it's just not my scene, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm a visual learner. I'm a visual communicator, I think. But there's a lot of stuff on Twitter that is very interesting. A lot of people that use it to great effect. And what I'm saying is you are one of those people, my friend.
That is very kind.
But you know I see your tweets, though? Mm-hmm. I see them reposted as Instagram stories, like at other times.
Oh, you're talking about me.
You personally.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because I want to reach the audiences. I mean, I don't...
No, 100%,
I don't think
but
it's
I'm saying
denigrating at all.
No, not at all, but you're reaching me as well in that way, and I think it's smart to do that.
Oh, well, thank you. But also, thank you to super producer Casey Pegram. Thanks to, of course, Gabe. Where would we be? You know, we got to get Gabe on the show at some point.
We got to get Gabe on the show. He doesn't live here in Atlanta, though.
Yeah, we'll have to get him to call in, or maybe we'll fly out to him.
Where does he even live?
He's a man of mystery.
Yeah, he really
is. He's a man of mystery. But our pals, Mango and Will, got him on Part-Time Genius one time.
That's right.
So it's doable.
They probably know where he lives.
Yeah, but they won't tell me.
It's kind of weird that we don't you think?
It is a little weird.
He's just sort of this disembodied, like, voice in our inbox that comes through with really great history ideas.
Would it be hilarious if he lived here?
What if he's a bot?
What if he is a bot? What if we get that? What if one of us gets that?
The most advanced Russian bot ever created.
And we ask him for something, and he goes, "I'm sorry, Ben. I can't let you do that.
I can't let you do that."
Is that the line? Space
it's something.
Odyssey?
It's very close. It's very close. But no, absolute thank you to Gabe, because we would be nowhere without him. Or we'd be at least half as far along, for sure. Thanks to Jonathan Strickland, for goodness gracious, for picking up the reins in a big way in a non-quizster role.
Yep.
When I was away on adventures. I haven't listened to the episodes yet, but I'm sure they're gangbusters, and I'm really grateful that he was able to come in and keep the history machine a-churning.
We had a great time. You were missed. We learned a lot about poop heist, which is going to be hilarious if you run into it. So we also want to thank Alex Williams, who composed our track, and we want to thank, of course, Bass Reeves.
See you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.